So welcome everyone to this interview, where I'm really happy to be talking with Dr. Catherine Ford. Firstly, Catherine, welcome and thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So I've been looking forward to this interview. I think this is a really important kind of practical piece, which is really at the heart of what happens in relationship. And I think sometimes we can get caught in too much in the stories, the ideas, the history, the theory around it. And what I'm really excited about getting into is just this really critical piece of presence and awareness and the place from which we meet people. Just to give people a bit of Catherine's background, Dr. Catherine Ford is a teacher, clinician, and developer of the Learning Partners and Aperture Awareness. Through her method, Catherine guides couples in staying in the present moment, which she explains is the key to a successful relationship. It's where the learning and development takes place. Catherine has been practicing psychotherapy and in private practice for more than 20 years. She received her MD from Brown University Medical School and completed her psychiatry residency at the Stanford School of Medicine. She specializes in relationships of all kinds and is available for private consultations and workshops for couples, teams, and therapists. Her workshops are also available through Stanford Continuing Studies. So, Catherine, I think a helpful foundation here would just be to open up a few of the core pieces of the work that you have been developing, particularly this idea of emotional aperture and aperture awareness. So when you're speaking of emotional aperture, aperture awareness, what do you actually mean and why are they so important?
Yeah. So let me start by saying kind of how I came upon it, because this is certainly isn't an idea that I was taught in medical school or in my training in psychology. I started out as most people do. I started out a little differently than most people. I knew I was going to be a therapist, but on the way to doing that, I decided to go to medical school because I did already feel like that the mind-body connection was going to be a lot more important increasingly during the course of my career.
So I'm going to interrupt you. You're going to be a therapist as a child? I'm really curious about that. How and why?
Certainly by the time I got to college, probably the story actually starts with my mom and dad. My father was one of the very early pioneers in the psychology of the business place. He went around the country teaching seminars to people who had workplace dilemmas and basically talked to them about their interactions.
Wow.
So I was kind of growing up on that. And my mother had a late life career as a psychologist. So by the time I was off to college, I was very interested in psychology and became increasingly interested in the not just the metaphysical part of it, which was kind of where psychology was then, but also the physical part of it. I had the good fortune when I went to medical school to the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry happened to be a family systems expert. And I found that my tour on his ward, where we were looking at human beings in their relationships, was about the most exciting thing I had seen. And so at that point, I had a strong hunch that I was going to end up working either with couples or with families. The next piece that kind of entered in there was as I was doing therapy and I started, like most people do, working with individuals one-on-one, I began to get kind of stuck. And I would realize that the ideas I had and the ways that I was trying to process what I was hearing from the person I was talking to were not quite big enough for what I was hearing. During that same time, I was also starting to learn mindfulness and become a student of meditation. And there was a point at which I remember thinking, I'm just going to jump the fence. And jumping the fence meant I'm going to go outside of the playground that my training has provided for me. And I'm just really going to listen and see if I can find something new in this. And that was probably the first moment that I was pulled away from my thinking process and trying to figure things out according to the models that I'd been very well taught, and simply trying to figure things out based on listening more carefully and being more in the moment. The other thing that happened about that time was I decided that I would do an experiment usually when you're doing therapy with people, you see them individually and you don't bring in their partner unless they ask you to. But I decided that as an experiment, I would work with people for a while where early in meeting them, I would also meet their partner for just a social visit, not a therapy visit, not trying to work with them, just to get to know them. And very quickly, what I realized is that that gave me a window on who this person was, without which I would have been stumbling around in the dark for quite a while. So
That's such an interesting point, because one of the things that I've noticed over the years working as a therapist is that people can build a story and a narrative and how they describe the people in their lives, which inevitably informs the perspective we have. And sometimes when you meet that partner, it's completely different to the story that's been built. And it gives a whole different, as you say, a different frame of reference.
Yes, exactly. So that turned out to be really important. And soon thereafter, I really shifted towards this feeling. Tony Kushner, the playwright, says the smallest human unit is two. And I shifted strongly in the direction of, right, the strongest human unit is two. We are so well built for relationship. And many a times I would be talking to people, they would be talking about their relationships. That was the story they were telling me and the pain that they were in. So pretty soon I decided I'm just going to work with people as a couple. And so many years ago, I decided that's it. That's what I do. And I love it. And I find it very energizing. And I feel, I don't know, I guess the word calling has some overtones, but I do feel like this is what I was meant to do, is to talk to couples about their relationship and help them find their way through there, including the fact that it works really well for me that it doesn't, a couple usually is not in difficulty because something's wrong with one of them. And so this is not about the medical model of pathology. This is about understanding that couples are a developmental unit and that we are meant to, as our recent neuroscience tells us so well in terms of neuroplasticity, we're meant to continue to develop throughout our lifetimes. The old idea that we get the brain we've got and by age 7 or 12, that's it, is we've thrown that out now. We realize that we continue to learn as long as we're alive. That's what we're built to do.
Although interestingly, you say that often people do come to therapy ultimately because they think something is wrong. And,
yes,
and normally they come because they think their partner's wrong and they want you to fix the partner, right?
Yes,
that's often what instigates someone coming to couples work.
Yes. And it's also what discourages them. Imagine you're in a couple, things are not going well, as they often don't in couples, because it is a developmental path and you're supposed to be learning things. But they come in very discouraged because they feel like either something's wrong with my partner or something's wrong with me or something's very wrong with our choosing each other. We chose the wrong person, right? And it's quite a relief to discover that that's not really what's going on, and it's not at all a helpful way to look at it. And instead, what's going on is that being in a relationship, especially of the kind these days, people and couples expect a lot of being a couple. This is no longer, for most people that I work with, this is no longer about survival issues. This is no longer about they won't make it as physically unless they have a partner. This is now about, I want you to be a best friend. I want you to understand me. I want us to think about things together. There's a very big agenda there. And so it's very important that people understand the big agenda is fine. The other thing people come in with is saying, my expectations are too high. We should just realize that, being a couple isn't all it's cracked up to be, and you have to settle. And I don't think that's useful at all. Being a couple is so hard that, in fact, you need a very big vision to inspire you to go forward. There's one variable missing from that vision usually, and that's understanding that vision is about what you're here to learn. And so when you change, we're here to support each other through thick and thin, to we're here to learn how to support each other through thick and thin, the whole thing opens up.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. And I think it is one of the real challenges of relationships these days, that it's never been easier for people to leave a relationship, right? And yet the demand on what people expect from a relationship gets bigger and bigger and bigger, which I think is difficult.
It is very difficult. It is very difficult. I realize I've wandered away from your early question, and I actually want to go there.
It was a great answer. but I think that also gives us really helpful foundation to you and your work, which I think is really important. So, but you touched on a little bit a few times as you were talking. I think that this piece of, it's not just the story and the history and all of the, and it's interesting to me particularly that a practitioner such as yourself, who clearly has a very strong intellectual background, having been a medic and a psychiatrist, and the rigor that one has to go through to be successful in that work, that actually this key building block of the way that you work is actually not all of that. It's actually coming into the present moment.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. So now we're into the part of my work where I was working with couples all day long. That's what I did. And I had always been involved with other therapists as a teacher. And so I began to teach about couples. And as I started to teach about couples, I started to ask myself, so something that I'm doing is giving me a clear path as to how to work with a couple and making it not so hard and complicated. What is that? And I started to ask myself, what is it I'm using as I'm doing a session to guide me forward? And I realized what I have my eye on is the openness for connection between these two people. Are they open for connection? And if not, what's in the way? And then, of course, that's what I would try to help them with. So I began to think of it sort of like a road with big boulders. And I was the person to come along and move the boulders and clear the path for the connection. I also began to very strongly believe that the most important thing someone can do for you if they're helping you with your relationship is clear the path between you. Two people that are connected enough that they're coming in as a couple definitely have the resources on board if they can only put them together, but they can't put them together when the path is blocked and when they're not talking well to each other, when they're not trusting each other to listen, etc. So one day, as I was working with a couple, I just grabbed out of the air the word aperture, you know, from photography, as a way of describing to them what I wanted them to pay attention to. I said, you know, I'm noticing that your aperture to each other is closed. And they kind of looked at me quizzically. And I said, here's what I mean by that. And I very briefly explained, it's all about being open to each other. And when I say aperture, I mean, how open are you to each other? That couple, and then a few couples subsequently that I tried out this new term on, it worked so easily, like it wasn't a very big reach for them. They quickly kind of got what I was talking about. And so I began to use that term more and more. At that point, I thought, okay, I've got it. My job here is to teach people to be aware of their apertures, to be able to sense their own aperture and their partner's aperture to them. And then there came a session pretty soon after that where I was working with a couple and he's talking to her and she's starting to close down. And the more she closes down, the faster he talks, the louder he talks. He starts to repeat himself. He starts to gesticulate and he's really going at it. And she's getting more and more close.
You know, it's not describing me talking to my wife right there.
or me to my husband, right? So I stopped him and I said, hold on a second. I said, what's going on with her over there? And he said, well, she's closing down to me. And I said, right. And I said, so if you noticed that, why did you keep talking? And he said, I didn't know what else to do. And the light bulb went off for me. I went, oh my gosh, right. People do sense this. That's, in fact, what we get so bollocks up about and nervous about as we're talking to each other. When we start to sense our partner closing down, we do sense it. We just don't pay attention to it and we don't respond to it because we don't know what to do with that information. And at that point, I realized, no, actually, people are probably very well equipped to sense aperture. They just don't pay any attention to it because they don't know what to do with it. My job is to teach them what to do with it.
I think that's a great analogy. And I'm sort of tracking it into my own relationship. I notice that what happens is that my wife can respond in certain ways. And exactly as you described, I do what I do faster, harder, quicker as a way to try and fix that.
Right.
It's what's been very helpful over the years is to try and catch those patterns and go, hang on, my wife is closed. Me trying to analyze and fix the problem right now closes her down more, gets me more frustrated. Yeah. And it's like having the language and the awareness to catch that can be very powerful, can't it?
Yes. And what you just said is excellent. You realized that what you were doing wasn't working. And that's actually the first piece of learning anything, but learning this is to bring yourself present enough that you notice what your usual pattern is. And then step two is to not do the usual pattern.
I guess the challenge is often that one can identify what's happening kind of conceptually or intellectually. They can say, hang on, my wife is shut down. I'm trying to force her open and it's not working. But we're often in those moments, we're also emotionally charged and driven, right? And so we've lost contact with our own ground.
Yes, exactly. Which is brings us to the fact that our apertures are very resonant with each other. I happen to have a drum in my behind me here. I used to play the drum. And what I realized is when you're in a room with several drums and you hit one drum head, all the drum heads vibrate. And that's who we are emotionally. We resonate with each other very powerfully. And the more connected we are overall to the person we're with, excuse me, the more resonant we are. So the big asset and the big problem in couples is that they're very resonant with each other. So if you look for why your wife is shutting down, the most likely thing is that you had started to shut down before that and didn't realize it. Or maybe you started to shut down because she started to shut down because you started to shut down. And that's the resonance. And we love that resonance in wonderful moments. That's actually what we love about being a couple is she smiles and you smile bigger. And then pretty soon you're both giggling. But when it's a bad feeling or a difficult feeling or some tension, the most likely thing that will shut your aperture down is her aperture starting to shut. And so often we notice our partner's aperture shutting before we notice our own, which is interesting. And it should be a clue to us, oh, wait a second, let me check and see, is it possible that my partner's shutting down because I had started to close down and I wasn't really aware of it?
And I think it's also difficult. I'm thinking about why are relationships often so difficult? That these are really deeply trained patterns, right? Like if we, I seem to be using the example of my own relationship. So to take that a step further.
That's okay. That's what we all have, right?
Well, exactly. So to take it a step further, like I can imagine coming home from work, being in a kind of wired stress state where I've been very much in problem solving mode. So I've been in kind of lots of meetings, solving problems, doing this, doing that, coming home, and I might see that my wife is drained and tired and maybe the kids have been acting up or whatever. So my instinct is in that moment, because I'm disconnected and I'm stressed, is to start solving problems. So to start saying, let's do this and sort that out. And of course, it doesn't always go down very well. But what's happening is I might have the story that I'm being open and I'm being because I'm trying to help, but actually I'm doing it from this disconnected and from this effectively emotionally shut down place.
Yes, exactly. And so she is going to respond more strongly to your aperture, to your shutting down than to anything else. She's not even probably going to notice that you're trying to be helpful. And this is something that I often talk about as emotional contagion. And emotional contagion is particularly noticeable often when one person comes home from work and whatever each person is carrying, it can be very contagious. And so this is a point to be very especially mindful. And maybe as one is driving home from work or as you're opening the door, just kind of check in like, how am I doing here? And am I carrying something that might possibly be contagious, but not in a good way? And if so, maybe you want to say, you know, hold on a second. I need a moment because I just got in off the highway and I've had a busy day at work and I'm kind of grumpy. Let me go wash my face and I'll get back to you. And taking a moment to kind of regroup, recenter is a very important application of mindfulness. And a lot of people are learning mindfulness these days. And as far as I'm concerned, the most important place to practice it is in relationship. And aperture awareness is basically a subset of mindfulness. It's a mindfulness skill. You get aperture awareness is not something you can figure out. So when I'm talking to people about aperture awareness, as I said, I realized I'm not teaching them to do it. I'm simply pointing them to what it is they need to notice. Aperture awareness is a felt sensation. It's like our vision. We don't see things by analyzing every quantum piece of light that's coming in our eye and figure out the blues and the greens and the reds. We look and we see, and aperture sensations and awarenesses like that, once we know where to look for it. And it, for people that can't exactly figure, well, where do I look for it? Usually the first place to point them, especially if they haven't done any mindfulness practice, is just tune in right now. How open do you feel? So maybe even, you know, as you're watching this video, you know, think about how open do I feel to watching this video? Is this great and I feel wide open and this exciting? Or do I feel a little nervous? What's she going to talk about? Maybe I'm half open, half closed. And so just tuning in the moment to open or closed, that's where you point your awareness to look for aperture awareness.
And that is a real, it's a discipline, but it's also a practice, isn't it? Because, yes. You know, learning through, for example, meditation, mindfulness practice, to be able to bring one's attention back to their body and to the moment, that's often not easy at the start. And it can take some time to really cultivate that capacity.
Yes. Yes, it can. It turns out, you know, about 100 million years ago, I think I just got the zeros wrong, but a very long time ago, when we were still in the caves, human beings learned a new skill. And what we learned to do was to think about things that were not present and were not current. So you often hear when people talk about mindfulness, they talk about be in the here and now. The reason we have to train ourselves to be in the here and now, the reason sometimes it's not so easy to be in the here and now, is that we have a very, very strong survival advantage programmed into our brain because of the fact that we figured out how to not be in the here and now. And so it turns out that we've overlearned that skill and we're very good at abstracting. And thus, when we think too much, it gets in the way of this kind of mindful awareness. There's a study that was done, a couple of researchers put an app on people's phone. I think this was a group of students. Usually these experiments are done with students. And every few minutes during the day, a tone would go off and the person would need to log in about whether or not they were present in the moment, meaning their attention was on what they were actually doing. And then they would also give a rating of how happy they were at that moment. It turns out 57% of the time, we're not in the moment. We're not present with what it is we're actually doing. So more than half the time, we're there and then instead of here and now. And what it also turns out is that we're not particularly happy when we're doing that. The moments that we're the happiest is when we are in the here and now. So there's a big advantage beyond just getting along with your mate to showing up in the here and now. But it does take some retraining because we have centuries of evolutionary history that have sent us in the direction of imagining the animal that we were going to go hunt, imagining the person that was going to come to our door and disrupt our lives. So imagining what could happen to us and where our food was going to come from became very important at a certain point. And so we have to retrain ourselves because it's really no longer about that level of survival again.
Yes. And there's something also, I think, about being present to what is, even when it's painful or it's difficult, that somehow we're more connected, right? I think it's the same in our own inner work, that we can be in a really painful place, but actually in a strange way, we feel more alive than we do if we're just disconnected. I think the same is true in relationship, that sometimes we can really have on the table some really, you know, difficult stuff, but somehow we feel closer because we're in truth and we're in that shared experience.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's an important thing to learn. And sometimes it takes some risky feeling experimenting to learn that. And the risky experimenting can have to do with the fact that you're not quite sure it is a good idea to tell your partner that actually when they just shared their sad story about what happened to at work that day, that actually you didn't feel compassion. What you felt was anxiety because you got really worried about how they were going to be able to go back to work the next day if it was so bad, right? But sharing that, whatever the feeling actually is a lot better than not sharing anything or than sharing a false feeling because of this aperture awareness we have, we pick up very quickly on a person kind of drawing the screen over what's happening. And, you know, we're together, whether we're in couples or in other relationships, we very much want the connection that we get from relationship. So when somebody draws the curtain and kind of hides what they're feeling from you at a crucial moment like that, it feels very disconcerting and it actually feels very threatening. It feels more threatening than if the person pulls the curtain aside and says, well, you know, actually, I know I should be feeling compassion for you, but I got really anxious. I got worried that you wouldn't be able to go to work tomorrow. Now you're in a conversation where two people are sharing real feelings. Part of why that's important, people think that when they're listening compassionately to another person, that what they're supposed to be doing is totally losing themselves in that person's story, feeling that person's feelings and feeling empathetic with them. But actually, and especially between life partners, that's not what really happens. If I have a particular feeling and I share it with my husband, there's no telling what he's going to feel, but he's going to feel something. Because he's so connected to me, right, he may feel irritation that I share that with him. He may feel sympathy. He may feel frustration. Gee, she just keeps feeling that feeling. I wonder why she doesn't do something about it. So he's going to have a feeling reaction, and that's what gets very tricky about the kinds of conversations that couples most want to have, which has to do with that part of the relationship that's about shared experience and companionship and support during the hard times. But inevitably, my difficult emotional feeling is going to generate a somewhat tricky emotional feeling in my partner very often, not always. And so figuring out how to share all of that, how to take turns, how to talk about all of it without any of it being the wrong thing to be feeling, is a very complicated skill that gets a lot easier when you start to pay attention to open or closed.
Yes.
And that's why the simplicity of open or closed is so important.
And it also strikes me that as one is sharing and communicating to their other half, to their partner, let's say, there's sometimes one's using too many words and the other is closing down, or sometimes one's blaming the other in a way that, and it strikes me that the more sensitive one is to how open or closed their partner is, the more able they are to actually communicate in a way that's really going to be heard, as opposed to just vomiting everything they're thinking and feeling onto that person in a way that actually doesn't get them the what they ultimately want, which is to be seen and heard by that other person.
There are two things that are really important about that. One is, yes, when we're talking to someone we care about, what we most want is to be seen and feel and heard. We want to be understood. We want to be heard accurately. And so imagine if you're talking to someone whose aperture is closed, that's not going to happen. In a certain way, the most important thing you can do to be sure that you get seen and heard by your partner is to help them have an open aperture to you. And so, yes, that has to do with the way you talk to them and how fast you talk to them and how well you tune in to, oh, I'm starting to lose them. They're shutting down. The most, I do a lot of exercises with couples to teach them this stuff. The exercise that seems to be the most powerful for people and that people really relate to the most strongly, again, is quite simple, but I just have them in a very structured way slow down a lot. And the way that I get them to do that is they're to only say one or two sentences at a time. And then they're to pause for a space of time as long as one or two sentences. So that's a long pause.
And that's hard when you've got a lot you want to say. Right?
Exactly. So we all feel, I mean, what could you possibly completely say in one or two sentences, right? And so this push to want to feel understood and connected with gets us to say 17 sentences without noticing that by the third sentence, the other person's eyes are glazing over, right? They're closing down. So if instead you say two sentences, and then there's this big long pause so that your partner can absorb what you just said, and even you can absorb what you just said. And then your partner says two sentences back, which gives you a chance to hear right away, well, how did you feel about that? How did you hear me? Did you understand me? And then there's another long pause for both of you to kind of work with all of that. Things get really slowed down. It's like a very slow lobbying process in a tennis match. You know, in a tennis rally, most of the time the ball is traveling. It's only being hit a very small amount of the time. And this rhythm is kind of like that. And it is hard. It requires some discipline and kind of reminding each other, oh, wait, that was two sentences. You need to pause. But once they get the hang of it, inevitably couples, that it's like their face lights up. It's like, oh my gosh, that changed everything. For the first time ever, I felt like she was listening to me. For the first time ever, I felt like I didn't have to rush to get it all out because I knew that we were going nice and slow, and pretty soon I was going to get to speak again. And so the conversation unfolds in a very different way, and it's a very powerful way for people to learn to pay attention to aperture while they're actually talking to their partner. So this is maybe my favorite exercise to give people. It's just extremely powerful.
Yeah, I think it sounds really helpful. And what comes to mind as well as you're speaking, you didn't quite use these words earlier, but you kind of talked about this idea that there's the two people, but there's also this thing in between these two people. Like there's this additional being, like living, breathing thing, which is the dynamic of the relationship. And what I'm really hearing and what you're saying is that really respects and supports that really important piece.
Well, absolutely. You know, the other very important thing for couples to realize is that being in a couple is by definition a relationship that you've kind of predefined as not adversarial. But many of the things we know both instinctively and in our heads about relationships are adversarial. If you think about it, open the newspaper and what is every story about? It's about who done it, to whom, and what price are they going to pay? This is all about adversarial relationships. But that's not what you're trying for in a couple. So the rules are completely different. And one of the rules that's completely different is that the best way for me to get my needs met is to make sure that we're both getting our needs met and to make sure that we're both taking care of the relationship. What's going to make me the happiest, and there's research about this, of course, also, is that when I get up in the morning, I feel like I'm in a good place with my partner. He's in a good place with me, and it's probably going to be a pretty good day. On the other hand, imagine those days that we all have, but it's not quite like that. And you wake up in the morning thinking about the fight you had the night before, and you feel kind of dreadful, and it feels not easy to get up, not easy to go off to your work. You're kind of worried all day. Are we going to be okay? So it's the variable of how's my couple doing? What's happening in my relationship? Turns out to be maybe the biggest factor in our happiness when we are coupled. Yes. And so keeping an eye on, in any conversation, I tell people, the most important outcome is how did this conversation affect your relationship? It's more important than solving the problem. It's even more important than being heard accurately. Being heard accurately is very important, but it comes right after that. The interchange we have needs to leave us with a good feeling about ourselves, our partner, and the relationship.
And also comes to my mind as you're speaking is that relationships are so much more complicated. You were saying about the news, and for some reason I was thinking about, I was rewatching some of the Star Wars films the other week. Right. And it's a very simple portrayal of right and wrong, right? There's the light side and there's the force, yes, the sort of the good side. And we can very easily in relationships get into this, I'm good and my partner is bad. And this very kind of black and white binary way of thinking. And again, what I'm hearing you say is the importance of seeing the nuance and not subscribing to these sort of rigid perspectives that then just get into blaming and shaming of the other, for example.
Exactly. Many of the tangles that people get into, couples get into, other relationships get into in conversation, many conversations are about the need to integrate two people instead of just within one person. It's about the need. When we say two heads are better than one, we're not kidding, but we often don't know how to actualize that. So a conversation very often is about bringing together differences, whether it's a literal conversation, me talking to you over coffee, or whether it's the bigger conversation in society. We're trying to bring together the differences and figure out how to make something that includes all of the differences and is even better than that and is bigger because of that. And so couples get into this dilemma constantly. Couples are constantly disagreeing about where they want to go to dinner, about who said what that morning when they decided that who was going to pick up the kid. A very funny one time was no one picked up the kid. And listening to the couple talk about it, she was absolutely certain that he was supposed to pick up the kid. He was absolutely certain that he wasn't and that she'd never say anything about it. When we started from the perspective of, let's assume that you're both right, that what you heard was she's going to pick up the kid, and what she thought she said was you're going to pick up the kid. Now, what do you see about this picture? And very soon they got to, oh, I see how we misunderstood each other. You said you weren't going to go to work today, and I thought that meant you were picking up the kid.
No, of course, so, no one deliberately didn't pick up the kid.
No one deliberately didn't pick up the kid, right? And so very often couples need strategies for figuring out how to get into the tangle where it feels like you're living in different universes, you're living in different worlds. One of my favorite tools for that is to remind people to use grain of truth. When your partner says, especially when your partner's giving you feedback and they tell you something about yourself that you're not totally sure you like that. In fact, that often happens. Instead of trying to figure out, are they right or wrong? Because you're never going to totally agree with them. They have an outside view of you. You have an inside view of you, right? Instead, go for what's the grain of truth in what they're saying? What's the thing that I know about myself or maybe about what I said this morning that might resemble what my partner's saying? It doesn't have to be identical. It's just where's the place that I can find, oh, I see what you're talking about. That's not exactly the way I think about it, but I can see why you would think about it that way, because from this angle, it's sort of, and once you go looking for a grain of truth, you're out of the dilemma of butting heads about who's right or wrong. And you have to know that as soon as you find yourself in a discussion about who's right or wrong, you're definitely in a conversation that's going nowhere faster than you want it to.
You're on the wrong path, yeah. It also reminds me, I know in the notes that you shared before the interview, that you make a distinction between accepting blame and repair. Like, say a bit about that, and that's an important piece here as well.
Yes, that's really important. People get very nervous about apologies and, in fact, don't offer apologies because we think that apology is tantamount to accepting blame. We think that apologizing means I was wrong, you were right, I screwed up, you were the victim.
Like politicians, right? Never apologize.
It means that you're the victim. Exactly. And so it's very tricky. It turns out that when we injure each other, there are three things that can get damaged or broken. The first one is the empathetic connection. A lot of what couples have with each other is a tacit assumption that I care about your experience, you care about my experience. I care about how you feel, you care about how I feel. When you get injured, sometimes in a big way, sometimes in a small way, that's called into question, like, did you mean to step on my foot? And so the first thing to repair is the empathetic connection. oh, sorry, I didn't see you there. I didn't mean to step on your foot. I'm really sorry. Are you okay? That reestablishes, of course, I care about your feelings and how your foot feels. I made a mistake. I didn't see you. So that's the first thing to repair. The second thing that gets broken when injuries happen is a consensual reality. That's a really tricky one. We all depend on seeing more or less the same thing in our world, and especially couples. Part of what makes a couple is they build a reality together and they like that many things they see similarly. So when there's an injury, there can be a bit of disruption about, wait a second, I thought you were picking up the kid. Are you kidding me? I think something's wrong with your hearing. In fact, I don't think you listen to me anymore, et cetera. And so there's a disruption in what happened there. That repair is trickier. And so I often advise, that's the repair that sometimes gets into who is right or wrong. So the third repair is about repair of agreements. The good thing, and you really need to repair all three of those things. Repair of agreements is about the fact that when there's a mistake made or a misunderstanding or somebody screwed up and wasn't kind, there can be a question of, I thought we agreed we were going to be kind to each other. Like, are you intending to be unkind to me? And usually the repair of agreements boils down to simply reasserting, yeah, I know, I do agree that we should be kind to each other. I was in a really foul mood. I didn't control myself. Really sorry. And so that reasserts, yes, we do have the same goals here. We have the same agenda. We are trying to be kind to each other. And so that repair is often very quick. The first repair, the empathetic repair, is the most important and fortunately the easiest. And part of why it's easy is you don't have to establish who did what or who's right or wrong. To simply establish, no matter what happened, I don't want you to have a bad experience when I'm around. And no matter what happened, I know that you don't want me to have a bad experience. And if you make the empathetic repair and you can't agree about, well, what did happen there, because that's really tricky, it kind of matters less. And people get so concerned with, was I right or was I wrong? Did I err or did I not err? That we go instantly, most of the time, into a stance of, I wasn't wrong. Or if I was wrong, it was because you were cranky first, right?
It's your fault that I'm in the wrong.
Yeah. Right, exactly. I know I was cranky, but you were cranky before that. So sometimes you want to not do that repair at all. And you certainly don't want to be the first thing you attend to, but it's really not necessary. One of my favorite cartoons that I saw is a man's going into a flower shop and he's saying to the florist, what kinds of flowers say I'm sorry without admitting to any wrongdoing?
That's great.
And that's the concern, right? For men, for women, all of us. And that's what we need to learn to do, is to say we're sorry without admitting wrongdoing. And we need to learn to accept that kind of apology. That the most important thing is you care about how I feel. And yeah, maybe I think you seriously screwed up and maybe you don't, but overall, I know that you still care about such things and you're not intending to do me wrong. And that's what's important. And that's what's important about the repair. And the really good thing is you can do that part even if you can't do the other parts.
It's like it's someone once said to me, it's a choice between, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? Because you probably can't have both.
Exactly.
Right? And
exactly.
It takes a courage and it takes a vulnerability to sometimes be willing to inquire into how we might have, perhaps unintentionally, but how we might have actually done something that hurt someone that we love. And it's not always easy to go there.
Yes, yes. And it's so important to go there, because very often, if you can both go there openly to the second part about, well, what really happened here? What you often discover, more often than not, what you discover is a misunderstanding. That's a real freebie, because you simply didn't get your signals straight. And so that's kind of one of those no fault mistakes. It's like, oops, you know, I was rushing out the door. I didn't hear you properly about picking up the kid, right? What you might discover in addition to misunderstandings is mistakes. And when you can discover a true mistake and can own it, that's practically as good as a misunderstanding. In other words, because what it asserts is, yeah, I'm still a good person and I still do intend to do right by you. I still agree that raising my voice when I'm upset with you is not the right thing to do. I made a mistake. I got hot under the collar. You're totally right. I shouldn't have yelled at you. I do want to talk to you about what I was upset about, but you're right. I made a mistake in the yelling part. Really sorry. I'm going to keep an eye on it. And what that says is, yeah, we're in a relationship where we care about the standard of treatment here. We're trying to treat each other well. We're trying to give each other a good experience. So again, as you go through the what actually happened, if you can keep your eye on, was there a misunderstanding? Was there a mistake? And quickly own those. Sometimes you discover that's all there was either a misunderstanding or a mistake or a little of both. And you don't get into the territory that's actually much more serious, which is, oh no, wait a second, you actually do intend me harm and you're not having good feelings about me. And that's a much harder thing to deal with. But very often people spend a lot of energy and get very upset over things that in the end turn out to be a misunderstanding.
And I think what strikes me is that putting the first or second, we assume they're the third, right? Yeah. And that's yes, the, exactly. that's the danger, that you assume that a mistake right. or a misunderstanding actually right. has, you know, negative intentionality behind it.
Yes. And what we, yes, exactly. And we're, you know, we have our brain is wired so that we prioritize negativity and danger. So a part of our brain, which is the amygdala, gets a signal really quickly from the outside world and quickly goes into snake or garden hose. I'm going to go with snake because if it's a snake, I'm going to be in trouble, right? And so part of learning to be a couple is learning to wait while that instant fear response kind of calms down. And the fear response is what you just talked about, or is one version of it, which is something happened that really injured you. And because of our fear response, we can go very quickly to, uh-oh, am I with the wrong person? Have you stopped caring about me? Have you suddenly overnight turned into a louse? What's going on here, right? And so if we can take a minute and kind of what I call ride the wave of that fear reaction, watch it come, watch it go. And if we're in basically a pretty good place with ourselves and our partner, that process actually only takes a few seconds. And if we can stop ourselves from speaking while we're in the fear response and instead let it come and let it go, that's another way of saying our aperture closes. So something happens, our aperture closes. If we speak at the moment that our aperture is closed, it's going to come out something like, I can't believe that you did that, you creep. What's wrong with you, right? And we're on the road to somewhere we don't want to go. However, if something happens that we don't like, we have that response, I can't believe they did that. What's wrong with them? And we kind of watch it come, we watch it go. And on the other side of that, our aperture can start to reopen. And we go looking for our second response. What's the response that's open aperture? That might be something more like, did you realize that hurt my feelings? Because I can't tell if you did. That's a response that's much more likely to help your partner's aperture stay open, which is what you want because you've been injured and you want them to understand that, right? So if you say, I don't know what just happened, but I got really hurt, that's much more likely to elicit an open aperture response where your partner might say, oh, wow, no, I didn't know that you got hurt. Tell me about that. And that's what you want.
Catherine, I'm mindful of time. There's still a million questions I want to ask, maybe another day. But for people that want to find out more about you and your work, what's the best way for them to do that?
Couple of ways for them to do that. I have a website. It's KatherineFordMD.com. And if you go to that website, you'll see things about who I am, and you'll also see things about where I'm presenting next and what kinds of things I'm writing. You'll see a blog post. I'm also a blog poster with Psychology Today. So if they go to the blogs on Psychology Today, you'll find me there. And I guess the third place would be I frequently teach with Stanford Continuing Studies. And many of those courses are either virtual courses right now because of COVID. And so anyone from anywhere, from London, can take that course. And also the courses are often recorded. And so you can also sign up for the course and then And then you have the recording and you can listen to it at your leisure. And those courses are sometimes just for couples, but they're often the one that I have coming up. I have a course October 2nd and 9th that will be a course for couples, singles, therapists, anybody that's interested in learning more about apertures and how to have a relationship that is more open and connected.
Fantastic. Catherine, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this interview. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. It was great.
Thank you.